federal grand jury questions witnesses in the JEA probe. A proposed 6-cent hike to Jacksonville's gas tax and chaos and confusion continue to surround the COVID-19 vaccination process. These are some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect. I'm A.G. Gankarski, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our media roundtable. 549-2937 is the number to call. Then later, how to see Canadian brass perform for free this weekend. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy news week, we welcome Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, AG.
Hey, thanks for coming on. Journalist Claire Goforth. Claire, good morning. Okay, we're having problems with Claire here. Mike Mendenhall with the Jacksonville Daily Record. Mike?
Good morning, AG. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, too. Thank you. And blogger, commentator, Fred Matthews. Fred?
Good morning, AG. Good to see you again.
Yeah, exactly. And Claire, I'm going to try you one more time. Claire, do we have you? Okay. All right, so lots to talk about this week. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Let's begin with the latest and continuing saga of the failed JEA sale and the ongoing aftermath, the story that does not go away. The federal grand jury that has been investigating the failed push to privatize the utility will soon begin hearing from witnesses. Nate, you broke the story yesterday, so let's begin with you. You know, what's going on here? What's the jury looking for? And are we going to cover another federal trial together?
Oh, man, those were the days, weren't they, AG? So I will say it's a little hard to know with a lot of specificity exactly what the case is that federal prosecutors are pursuing. There are a lot of reasons to think it involves, at least substantially involves, the so-called performance unit plan or bonus plan that the former JEA executive team put together. This is a plan that would have paid out executives potentially millions of dollars if JEA had been sold. It was scrapped during the sale process, but you know, private attorneys who reviewed that plan believe some of the representations that executives made about the lucrative nature of the plan to the board of directors were problematic. So I do think it seems likely that's what the grand jury is interested in.
Mr. White,
I'm on the radio
on 89.9 FM right now doing a radio show. Can I call?
Okay, yeah, we've the wonders of technology. Thank you.
Always fun.
Yeah, so Nate, restate that. Yeah, that end.
Oh, yeah. So federal prosecutors, I mean, you know, these cases take a lot of time to put together, and I think, you know, I've certainly encountered people with a lot of questions about it. What's going on? Is there still something going on? There is something going on. And so I do think we will see activity with this heat up in the next couple of months. And as soon as, you know, within, I'd say, 4 weeks, maybe sooner, we'll see, you know, witnesses starting to go in and out of the courthouse.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, once that happens, we know the timeline expedites. I think I have Claire back on. Claire?
You certainly do. I had a little technology issue there, but I'm glad to be on the air. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Why don't you weigh in on this JEA thing? You're a lawyer. When a grand jury, you know, starts questioning witnesses, are we toward an end game? Are we toward a criminal indictment? I mean, you've covered these things too.
I have, and you know, full disclosure, my spouse works for JEA. I do think that there are indications that we're going to be seeing a criminal indictment. The question on many of our minds is, who is the subject of this, or is it one individual or several individuals? I think that the smart money is on former JEA CEO Aaron Zahn at this point, and the performance unit plan, get-rich-quick scheme, basically. But there are some people who wonder whether or not there are members of the mayor's administration or the mayor himself who may be a subject of this. You know, even if we knew the identities of the people who are being subpoenaed, and I have not seen coverage that reports that, so please, if anyone knows who is going to be testifying, I'd love to hear who it is. I don't think that would really tell us one way or another who's the subject of this inquiry. I do think that because they're getting to the point where they're calling witnesses, there's signs that we may be yet again sitting on those hard benches in the federal courthouse and, you know, watching the trial of the potentially century.
Oh man, I'm too old for those benches. I'm gonna put you back on hold, Claire. Mike Mendenhall, you know, you see the scene at City Hall a lot. You know, what's the vibe there regarding this? Are people talking about this? People in council or staffers, or you know, what are you hearing?
Yeah, AG. Well, I mean, you know, you don't after since the city council's independent investigation wrapped up late last year in December, you really don't hear a lot publicly, but privately, a lot of city council members are watching closely, and I think there are several that expect an indictment. You know, and it's interesting if you look at that city council investigation, you can actually see some clues at least as to what the federal grand jury is kind of looking at. I mean, they're, you know, although the special counsel who investigated it for the city council, didn't determine any criminal wrongdoing or didn't state any criminal wrongdoing because that wasn't their charge. You know, they definitely noted, things like intentionally misleading JEA's board on the financial health of the utility. That would be by Mr. Zahn's senior leadership team. And to Claire's point, you know, they noted that the mayor's office, although, you know, no criminality had been stated in that report. And it's also important to note too that when the city council was subpoenaing witnesses, there were a couple of individuals that the federal probe urged the attorneys that were working with the city council to stay away from, JEA's former chief operating officer, as well as their former legal counsel, which seems to think at least the investigators on the federal level are talking to those people.
Yeah, I mean, those are excellent points, and that's a really great timeline. You know, and Fred, I want to get you in here. You know, you've got a lot of historical memory. You've seen the city through a lot of things, and you know, you've seen a lot of scandals, you know, come up to the, you know, doorstep of a mayor's office. You know, some people said this is the biggest thing in history of Jacksonville. I believe Rory Diamond condemned it that way. You know, one of the biggest heist attempts or what have you. Now that we're a little bit away from the drama of the JEA, like sale attempt, where does it rate in terms of, you know, city scandals of the past decades?
Well, it rates about average because today we have so much availability to media, social media and everything. And like many people, I read my paper online. at this point, and from wherever I am in the country or the state, I have access to all of the newspapers I want to read and all of the video episodes I want to read. And this is no different. The interesting part about this, of course, is that every day during this this JEA debacle, there was something in the paper, on the news, there was a reporter hanging out all over the place. The suspicions, of course, rose from the very moment that Aaron Zahn was on the JEA board, and how quickly he rose from an obscure member of the board to becoming CEO of one of the biggest corporations in Northeast Florida. And of course, the things that began to happen there. Not being surprised by the fact that a federal grand jury is taking over this thing, because, of course, everybody in city government is involved in one way or the other, right? Everybody knows everybody else. I'm not sure why the state attorney didn't do more with this case. We didn't necessarily see that anybody in her staff necessarily was involved in this, why we couldn't have gotten this from gotten something more from our own state attorney's office to get a grand jury investigation going. But we have to presume, again, that everybody's hands are being washed. Everybody's a Republican, for the most part, involved in this. So you can't very well have them involved. So we push it up to the federal grand jury. And there it will be for what? Nate probably knows better than this, but a year, 6 months, you know. And if you guys are not on another beat, maybe you'll get there in time to hear, to get a copy of the presentment when it comes out. It's basically that. But it's not as bad. Believe it or not, there were more people indicted and went to prison during the Godbold administration mm-hmm. than been indicted and gone to prison in this administration for a lot of the same or similar things. Okay. A lot of people went to prison back in the Godbold era and were indicted. We haven't gotten that yet, except for the offshoots of the state legislators who were, you know, involved in something else, but not this. I don't expect, to be honest with you, I really don't expect very much to come out of this other than a shame on you litany of sins from that grand jury.
Okay, so, you know, Nate, I want to get you in here real quick on this because, you know, we've got a change in the White House. We got a new attorney general, Merrick Garland. Joe Biden's our president, obviously. You know, we've seen the Republican administration go after Democrats in this city, you know, over, you know, time and time again. Does the dynamic change? Would the Biden administration perhaps have, you know, reason to want to, you know, perhaps destabilize Jacksonville political culture a little bit?
I mean, I think the machinery of the Department of Justice is vast enough that, you know, even if we assume that a case like this is one of the biggest in our city's history, I mean, I don't know that this rates with a lot of people in D.C. I mean, I don't know if this is going to be like something that, you know, Joe Biden is signing off on. I mean, keep in mind, the Kareem Brown prosecution happened under the Obama Justice Department.
Right.
So, I do actually, maybe to sound naive, I mean, I do think these prosecutions, at least on the kind of local level, are pretty, you know, nonpartisan or not motivated by who's holding the attorney general post at a given time.
All right. You know, we got a call here coming in. You know, Scott's calling from the north side. He's been waiting for a while. Thank you for waiting. Scott, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind here? Consolidation will be number one. Number two will be JEA, that attempted bamboozle.
Specifically on this JEA grand jury investigation, you know, give it to us in about 30 seconds. You know, what do you think is going to happen with this?
I think from the mayor on down should go to jail. You got about at least five people that was going to steal a bunch of money and set back this city forever. And that did not take place so far. I do not agree with Fred, what he was saying. This is a big bamboozle if it had been completed, because it would messed up a lot of people, especially underserved people, with the price of JEA going up and the whole nine yards. But
is that criminal? Is that criminal that
yes.
impact would happen?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. And it would have disenfranchised a lot of people regardless of race in Jacksonville.
Hey, thank you so much, Mr. Scott. Thank you. You know, Claire, I want to get you in on this, you know, because you've covered this JEA story as a reporter, obviously. And, you know, we're hearing that it's not going to quite get to that threshold that some people might have thought a year and a half ago when this thing started blowing up. You know, is that safe to say that, you know, expectations of a big show trial are too much or overblown?
You know, I do think that's true, AG. A lot of people, the caller who really was echoing the voice of many of those people, would have liked to see Lenny Curry or some high-ranking members of his administration or potentially his consultant be indicted. It looks increasingly less likely that that is going to happen. But let us not forget, you know, as Fred was referencing Aaron Zahn's meteoric rise and then equally meteoric fall, I mean, one day he's processing poop. The next day he's running one of the largest municipal utilities in the nation. And then the day after that, he's trying to sell it. We'd be kidding ourselves if we said that Aaron Zahn was acting of his own volition in that sale attempt. Nobody who's a serious person questions that the mayor's administration was behind it, as well as the very high net worth individuals who comprise the syndicate in Jacksonville, as Nate refers to them.
Mm. Okay.
So, you know, I mean, we're not going to get the people who are moving the pieces on the chessboard, but we may end up getting one of the pieces, and that would be Aaron Zahn.
Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot for that. You know, we've got so many topics there. We have to move on from this. We're still taking calls, 549-2937. Also this week, Mayor Lenny Curry and the Jacksonville Transportation Authority have been discussing the possibility of doubling the city's local gas tax with city council members to cover transportation projects around town. Nate, I want to tag you in on this because this is another story you broke. You had a heck of a week, sir. what's this money going to? Why do they need a new tax for it? And, you know, what will it free up in the budget? You're enthusiastic about this, and you don't usually cheerlead Curry proposals. So I want to hear you sell this to people.
Well, I'm probably not always a great salesman of ideas, but I mean, look, the fact that the city needs more revenue has been an underlying dynamic in a lot of discussions that have taken place, you know, even in Curry's administration. The JEA sale, I mean, one of the great motivators to sell JEA was the windfall of money that would go to the city. Lot J, I mean, I think a lot of the tension about Lot J was the city is strapped for money. There have not been big investments in neglected neighborhoods. And I think that was, you know, detrimental to the Lot J development agreement. I mean, I think that's, I think, you know, Lenny has reached a point where, I mean, there's no tool left. You know, the governments don't have a lot of ways to help people. One of the things it can do is invest in neighborhoods. Well, it takes money to do that. I mean, the gas tax is, you know, one of the more conservative friendly options for raising revenue. It is, critics will say it is regressive, and it is regressive. It means everyone pays, you know, the same rate. And I think that a lot of kind of right of center politicians prefer to think of it almost like a user fee. You know, it's money that drivers pay, and that revenue can only be used for road and transit projects. So, you know, this plan is, he wants to raise the gas tax by 6 cents. So we would charge a 12-cent gas tax like Nassau County and Clay County already do. And this would raise $1 billion, give or take, for JTA and the city to embark on this kind of large infrastructure investment plan. Part of that plan involves, because the city would have a dedicated funding source for road projects, it would free up money in annual budgets that the mayor says he wants to put toward septic tank phase outs, which has been a long running goal of, you know, environmental advocates and civic leaders and city officials. So, I mean, I think it's a creative plan. Not everyone's going to be happy about it, and it's not a perfect plan, but, you know, it's this or the city's just not going to have any more revenue for the next 2 years.
Yeah, and that's the choice. And Mike, you do deep dives in the city hall budgets and finance like nobody that I've seen. And, you know, can you speak to the pressure that the city's infrastructure budget faces even after economic good times and, you know, a lot of federal help and, you know, since the pandemic broke? I mean, you know, where is the city in terms of infrastructural needs, and, you know, how can this gas tax, you know, close some gaps?
Well, yeah, AG, I mean, if you just look at the list that the Curry administration and JTA have proposed, you're talking about $930 million of transportation-related projects, and all of those are already included in the CIP. I mean, those are projects that the city council said, yeah, we need to prioritize these. But if you look at the annual amount of money that the city spends on capital improvements, here I think this last year the Curry administration got a $230 roughly million dollar capital improvement plan, and that that just goes to show you like just how much money they have to play with versus what they need. And, you know, you look at the city council members here, I mean, you've got some conservative members of the city council that any raise in taxes is going to be a non-starter for them. I think Councilmember Rory Diamond, for example, I think told Action News Jax this week that, you know, he will not vote for a tax increase. But if you look at the list, every council member, all 14 council members, there's a project in every district that needs to be funded, countywide projects for road resurfacing. And these are projects that these council members can actually point to their constituents and say, look, you know, everyone's going to have to pay an additional 6 cents, you know, per gallon of gas, but this is what we're going to get for it. And I think that, you know, I think that this is probably going to be the most realistic way for the Curry administration to sell the city council on this.
Okay. I've got a call from a friend of mine, a friend of the program, Michael Hightower. We don't usually get you calling the program today, so what's on your mind? Welcome to First Coast Connect. Mike? Okay, he's not coming in. Okay, so Claire, I want to get you back in here on this gas tax situation and the regressive taxation model. Why not millage rate increase? Why not something that the ownership class bears more of a burden in? You know, because you know renters and people who have multiple jobs and long commutes, they're the ones who are going to be stuck with this, right?
They certainly are, and the simple answer is that there's not the political will for it. And the reason there's not the political will for it is partly due to the fact that those very same people who own large amounts of property really don't want to see that happen, and they're the campaign donors. I mean, this is a regressive tax in that its burden will be felt equally by all, but then it sort of disproportionately disadvantages people with long commutes and people who are impoverished. It's not a significant tax increase, really, but it's the only way that I think is politically expedient to raise the kind of revenue that we need. But there was one thing in what they're proposing to spend that I'd like to point out. Roughly $400 million for the Skyway. I think we can all agree that the Skyway is a bit in disrepair, but is it worth almost $500 million? To extend the line and replace the cars, that's a debate that we may want to have as a community, whether or not the Skyway is worth that kind of investment.
Yeah, and that's a great jump off point. You know, I want to ask you about this, Fred. I mean, we're looking to this investment list. The Skyway is a big part of it, obviously. Is there enough steak to go with the sizzle, you know, for parts of the town that have been neglected in terms of infrastructure? You know, the Skyway is definitely funded in here. The septic tanks seem more like an aspirational goal. You know, how do you sell a 6 cent a gallon tax hike to people, you know, who've been waiting for decades and decades for a city to come through and promises it never kept before?
Well, I don't think it'll be a very difficult sell. As you noted, I mean, as Nate noted in his article, and all of us know, the most surprising thing is that once again, we have a Republican-dominated administration full of conservatives on the city council, but we have a Republican-dominated administration proposing a tax increase. Now, granted, it's better than putting the toll booths back, but it is a tax increase, but it is a... Is it the right term, progressive, in that as everybody gets to put something into the kitty? Those people who are coming to work here from St. John's County and have to get gas in Jacksonville going back and forth, everybody gets to contribute to this. And it's not something that's going to sting you. And for many of those in lower income categories who have to access public transportation, they're not going to mind at all because they're catching the bus back and forth to work, and it will encourage more commuter work. So I think it's the best that could come up with financially for the city. It's not something that's going to sting everybody any more than the nearly $3 a gallon we're paying for gas right now without a 6 cents gas tax. So I think it's the best thing to come up with looking out over the future. And if this matter gets gets to the council and moves through, I think the mayor should be commended for at least proposing it in his lame duck session.
Huh. I that phrase lame duck session is interesting. You know, Mike, I want to ask you about that. Are you getting that feeling from City Hall that the mayor's making these legacy plays because it's getting to be, you know, close to the end?
I mean, you could argue that. I mean, if you look at, you look at the course of what the mayor has tried to do over his, close to 6 years now in office. I mean, he got pension reform passed early on, which was a big win for him. But you've got, as we were discussing earlier, the failed attempt to sell JEA, the failure to get Lot J through city council. I mean, there have been a lot of legislative and priority losses from the Curry administration, particularly as of late. So you have to be thinking, what can I do in my remaining 2 years? And infrastructure is something that will have a long-term lasting impact on the community. So I think there is a little bit of that. And, when you attend these meetings, whether it's the mayor's budget review committee meeting or a press conference, you do kind of see kind of like a, I don't know if you call it a swan song feeling, but definitely something that they're thinking about, what people are going to look at the Curry administration for, 20, 30 years down the road.
Yeah. I mean, that's usually where you get around the 3/4 mark, and that's about where we are. I want to shift gears a little bit. We all know what today is. We're a year into the COVID-19 pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic is still dominating the news and in many ways our lives themselves. This week, much of that news was related to continued confusion over who's eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine and how they can get it. Governor DeSantis talked about it in Jacksonville yesterday. He said that, 60-year-olds next week, 55-year-olds after that, and then eventually opening it up. But, we had a show a year ago this Friday. Claire Goforth, you were hosting. You're sitting in this chair when things changed at the Players Championship. I wanted to get your reminiscence on that. Tell us what that was like. Tell us, what that experience meant in retrospect, because, that was kind of when things changed for this program.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being quite nervous, just as a matter of course, because it was my first time guest hosting, and Melissa Roth leaves a very big chair to fill.
Yes, she does.
And then that news week, everything exploded. And I just remember that even beyond the normal jitters that you'll get the first time that you take on a task such as that, there was this sort of, you could just feel like the shoe dropping, and it was really unnerving. We normally were taking photos and laughing before the show, and everyone's sort of standing at a distance from one another, and just sort of there was this sense like we may not be in this place again for a while. And I mean, sure enough, now it's been a year and there has not been an in-person media roundtable since then. I mean, I miss you guys. I love it when we are all sitting around the table and having this conversation. And it's great to be on here now and to feel that connection. But man, don't we all sort of miss that, just going about our normal lives and, cutting up in between takes and things. I feel honored to have been the last and also sad that it's been so long. I look forward to this time next year when we're sitting around that table together again.
Yeah, I mean, that's beautifully stated, Claire. Thank you so much for that. And, that's really what we're seeing. I think a year ago when this started happening, we couldn't have imagined what this year would be like. And it set in very quickly. We're starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel. Fred, the president gave a speech last night saying that all adult Americans will be eligible for the vaccine by May 1st. the governor's expanding access. You know, we're seeing like individual sites basically letting exceptions to the rule, like caregivers getting shots in some places. So we're seeing universal adoption of the vaccine, or at least universal availability, becoming more and more of a reality, right?
It was a quite a heartening speech that the president gave last evening, and it was very, very hopeful. And I think all of us are looking forward to the day when we can have this shot available to all ages. And it appears that by June, certainly, and he announced that certainly by April, by May 1st, he's looking to have this opened up to everybody who wants to get the shot will be able to get it. We're pretty much seeing that in Florida right now with the opening up of the Walgreens stores throughout the county and, quite frankly, throughout the state, because you know they're going to give it to everybody they can. So with Walgreens CVS, I mean, that's a new place to get your shot where you don't have to get a whole lot of go down to the doctor's office and sit in line and do all that sort of thing. They're going to give you, they're going to get the shot. So it's a very hopeful time, and I would expect that certainly by this summer and by the opening of football season in the fall, that we will all be back together and pretty much living our regular lives. I'm in a household where both of us have gotten our shots, but our son has not because he's not been age-wise eligible to get his yet. So we're looking forward to him being able to do that. But I think that that will happen really soon, and we will be past that. We'll look upon this much like they looked at it in 1918 when the flu pandemic hit this country and hit the world, and more than 20 to 40 million people, I believe I read, passed away because of the flu epidemic. Started, that was first discovered among some Army personnel here in the States. So I think we'll look back upon this, but it will still be a terrible period with more than 500,000 people having passed away as a result of this. This is not something to ignore.
Right. And, you know, Governor DeSantis, he was in Jacksonville yesterday talking about the expansion of the Walgreens program. 16 sites in Duval County, he said, Walgreens will have the shot. You know, Johnson & Johnson will be available once it's open, but they're going to have Pfizer, I believe, Moderna. The FEMA satellite sites, listeners who may want to know about this, they are moving to their new locations March 14th, moving from Hammond Senior Center and Normandy Community Center to Carver Recreation Center and Ocean Way Community Center. No appointments necessary. These are walk-up sites, 500 vaccines each. Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer will both be there. And we're seeing eligibility changes, 60 plus as of March 15th, then 55 to follow. Then at some point, you know, by May 1st, according to the president, we said open. The governor has said demand and allocation are going to determine what Florida does. So, you know, if Florida gets the shots, he's ready to open it up. You know, Nate, when you look at this part of the process, the collaboration between the DeSantis administration, which you've criticized from time to time, and the Biden White House, it seems that things are working more competently and more smoothly, and they're staying off of MSNBC and CNN a little bit more with the state response. You know, so what's the narrative going to look like politically?
You know, that's a good question. I do think you're right that, you know, DeSantis isn't, you know, waving off federal help, right? Like, it's kind of an interesting dynamic to see the difference between a kind of state Trump Republican and a D.C. Trump Republican. Rick Scott in the Senate complains about, you know, the COVID relief bill wasting money on state aid. Ron DeSantis complains about Florida not getting enough money. I think that's sort of a dynamic that would explain, I think, to a large degree why you're right. There isn't this kind of animosity. I will say that I do feel like there is some tension between the way that, you know, kind of federal officials would like to see vaccine distributions move forward in Florida in the way that DeSantis and the state do. I mean, it's the Orlando Sentinel, I think, had a smart story yesterday that, you know, DeSantis started this vaccine rollout with a very kind of iron grip on distribution, I don't think there's any question now that he's lost grip on that. And that's in large part because a lot of these large FEMA sites and pop-up FEMA sites, they are, you know, I think correctly giving people wiggle room. If they're under capacity and they're not giving out enough vaccines, they are finding people who will take them. That is not something DeSantis has endorsed. There's no state policy for that. I think it would be better if there was. But I think what we're seeing is that a lot of these vaccine sites are kind of just not following the state guidance because it's not adequate anymore. I mean, there is not enough demand in the eligible population, and there is demand among everyone else.
Right on. You know, Mike, I want to get you in here on this very quickly, sort of a yes or no question. Could the mayor do more in terms of clarifying local vaccination policy? I mean, the mayor of Orange County basically made some changes there, and other city officials are doing that. It seems like there's kind of a laissez-faire approach in terms of vaccines, City Hall just basically tracking with the governor. Is that correct?
You know how I feel about yes or no questions, but I would say a soft yes.
Okay. Got a couple of calls here. Got Emily from Mandarin. Emily's actually got a Skyway question. Emily, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I'm just curious about the ridership on the Skyway and what the cost will be per person in the $400 million renovation. And if that's necessary in order to keep it open, is it a safety issue? I'm confused about, I don't think of the ridership as being that large.
Right. Thank you so much for that question. Nate, I'm going to let you answer that. You know, make the economic case for the $400 million for Skyway.
Well, I will say that I think the Skyway part of this proposal is probably the most politically tenuous. I mean, in some ways, that question is a little bit, I don't want to call it unfair. The Skyway has, you know, almost no organic ridership. I mean, but that is also what JTA hopes to remedy. You know, the Skyway is an outdated piece of infrastructure. It takes you to nowhere. I mean, it's the stops are not super practical. The cars can't hold enough people to, you know, move folks around and for like big events. And so what they're trying to do is modernize the Skyway and actually turn it into something that could be used. You know, say if you were in Brooklyn and you wanted to go to the stadium, it's the kind of thing that JTA wants people to feel like they can choose. So, I mean, the per rider cost would be enormous, only because, yeah, I mean, the Skyway is free and it's been free for years, and it's just not something people typically take. So, I mean, that's the real question. Do we want the Skyway to be something into this kind of practical transit system for downtown and Brooklyn and maybe Riverside one day? I mean, that's the real vision. And I think it's a fair question I think it's a fair criticism, sort of wonder if that is worth $400 million. That's something JTA is going to have to sell people on.
Yeah, absolutely. We got a couple more calls here. I want to get them in because we're starting to get short on time. Linda in Mandarin, you've been holding for a while. You got a question about vaccination announcements. Go ahead.
Yes, I tell my friends that in Florida, I have family all over the citizen getting vaccine in very non-progressive states like Georgia and South Carolina, and they couldn't believe I couldn't get one, but it's like Hunger Games in Florida to get a vaccine.
Yes, ma'am.
I think it's very interesting that the lock hole and the fundraising for the governor kind of coincided until the Miami Herald did story, and all of a sudden now we're going to be down to 60 and 55 in a couple of weeks, when before it was just like, wait your turn, I'm going to vaccinate all 65 and older, 4 million of them. Does anybody else besides me, who I can be a bit jaded, think that that's a coincidence? That suddenly we have liberalization of the vaccine ages within a couple of weeks of this focus, with people calling for federal investigation?
Yeah.
What's your thoughts?
I'm going to let Fred Matthews, thank you for the call, Fred, tackle that question. Do you think it's correlation, or do you think it's just more vaccines being available and allowing expansion? I mean, the governor says that as he expands, less and less people in each age cohort are even going to want it, so it's going to be closer to open. Where do you stand on this?
Look, the governor can only do what he is supplied to do. And up until January 20th, he was able to pretty much determine where things could go and when they were going to happen. And we all in the hinterlands had to deal with it. After January 20th, what we're seeing, what we saw happen was an actual plan got in place. An aggressive march began from, Pennsylvania Avenue to get everyone vaccinated with a plan that was going to be federally mandated. Now, from the parts that the governor can control and who he wants it to go to and what partnerships he wants to make locally, he can continue to do that. But guess what? All of his vaccines are coming from the feds.
Right.
And what you're seeing right now is that the feds have decided that they're going to get everybody vaccinated, period. And the governors can do whatever they want to do or don't want to do. But guess what? We're going to get these folks vaccinated. We're going to stop this confusion out there as to who's going to get it and when and what age. And that's what you're seeing taking place now. But yes, before January 20th, there was absolute confusion and chaos in the hands of every governor. They were all kingmakers. And of course, it's been a party line issue. But this is one reason why many progressives look to the federal government to get a lot of things done, because left to their own devices on the state level, they're only going to do what's politically beneficial to them and their benefactors. Yeah. So that's when changes are happening.
Right on. Thank you for that, Fred. We got another call. The calls are popping off. Aaron from Mandarin, welcome to the First Coast Connect. You got a question about taxes.
Yes, sir. I was wondering, either in lieu of or also on top of, why wouldn't Jacksonville propose some kind of tax on non-residents that work inside the city? We pay to get the jobs here, and, you know, quite honestly, St. John's and everybody else is setting up on our border and scalping our jobs, you know? So, I mean, it's not like they could vote against it.
Yeah, so okay.
It seems kind of like a no-brainer.
Okay, Nate, is that legal?
Well, I mean, I guess maybe. I mean, honestly, a gas tax is probably the closest you're going to get to taxing commuters who are living in the outlying suburbs and coming in. I mean, it's that or toll roads. And we had toll roads at one time and decided to get rid of them. I mean, that's really I think the gas tax is really one of the closest ways to do that. I don't think there are a lot of other tools available to cities and counties to tax people who are living in the suburbs.
Okay. Thanks a lot for that. We got another topic I want to move on to. This is such a stacked agenda as always, but the Jacksonville Jaguars. Claire, we've got you live here. Urban Meyer says that the Jaguars want a new team facility. How exciting. They need the best of the best, a brand new facility. Claire, what do you think of this? Do you think this is something Shad Khan's going to pay for, or they're going to present this to the taxpayers again for a public-private partnership solution?
Not if he can avoid it. I mean, he's a businessman, and he's demonstrated, as most NFL owners do, that he wants to get as much money out of us as possible. I think he'll have a harder time making that case while with the Jags' record under his ownership at present. But if, as many people hope, Urban Meyer comes in and we start to see some actual good things on the field, I mean, here comes the NFL draft. Maybe there'll be some difference made. Maybe not. Jacksonville has a very terrible record with the draft. But if we start to see some good stuff on the field, then maybe people will be more likely to say, hey, you know, let's give them a few million or $100 million, as it probably will be. But personally, as someone who's had a season ticket for over 10 years, what I really want, and I know that this is very expensive, is a dome. It's miserable in there.
Right on. So, okay, a dome, check. thanks for that. You know, we're going to want to hit one more news item because we're going to come up on a break soon. Al Ferrero, the city councilman, is looking to get into the Jacksonville mayoral's race this weekend. I want to ask you about this one, Mike Mendenhall. You know, this is going to be the third Republican who's seriously looking. Matt Carlucci is in. Daniel Davis is basically in and raising committee money. Who's going to vote for Al Ferrero? What's his lane, and what does that do to the race?
Well, Al Ferrero is, you know, kind of the social conservative of that trio of candidates. If he does decide to run and announce, you know, he kind of fulfills that, like I said, that social conservative role. Whereas Daniel Davis, the president of the chamber, is kind of your mainstream Republican. And Matt Carlucci is kind of a moderate. He's seen as a compromiser. One of the things, though, I think that the Councilmember Ferrero would come up against if he does decide to run is fundraising. I mean, we already have more than $2 million in fundraising that have happened between Matt Carlucci, who is a declared candidate, as well as Daniel Davis's, whose political action committee has raised money for what people are presuming will be the mayoral run. So there's already a lot of money going at these two Republican candidates. You know, they're both of them are pretty high. I think it's safe to say might be a little more high profile than Councilmember Ferrero. So he'll also, you know, have some name recognition to make up for. And so there's a lot of things that Mr. Ferrero is going to have to, you know, contemplate and strategize about if he decides to get into the race. And that isn't even, you know, we're not even talking about if a Democrat will decide to challenge any of the three Republicans.
Yeah, I wish we had time to talk about the Democratic Party again today. And I wish I had time to get a Nate Monroe's take on the Al Ferrero mayoral campaign and what a Ferrero administration would look like. But we're out of time for this segment. Thank you to this all-star panel, Dr. Nate Monroe, Claire Goforth, Mike Mendenhall, and Fred Matthews. Thanks for carrying the guest host through a media roundtable. In a moment, how to see Canadian brass for free this weekend. We'll be right back.
Taxes, the environment, energy, education, health care, a state that's gaining nearly 1,000 new residents every day, and the ongoing quest for resources to meet that growing need. These are critical issues that affect everyone in Florida, and they're just some of the issues we follow every week on Capitol Report. It's your direct connection to what's going on in Tallahassee and what it means to you.
Tonight at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
Officials are making plans for a Biden blitz. With his nearly $2 trillion rescue package ready for the presidential pen, Joe Biden is about to hit the road. But will his bet on big government pay off? Lots to talk about this week on the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The world-famous Canadian Brass plays the Florida Theater this weekend in a free concert presented by the Beaches Fine Arts Series. Melissa Ross spoke with the ensemble's Brandon Ridenour about it. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Brandon. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to being there.
It's so exciting to talk about this. Canadian Brass is perhaps the world's most famous brass group, an incredible brass ensemble, and coming to the Florida Theater. Tell us a little bit about the show.
It's true. We've been waiting a long time to be there, especially in these times now. Things just keep getting delayed and postponed, but we're definitely thankful to get to perform together again for real live people and with ourselves within the group. We actually haven't played a concert together probably in 5 or 6 months. of course, for obvious reasons.
Now, obviously, the pandemic is still going on, so at this performance, there will be some restrictions, right?
Yes. Yep, I think that the, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that procedures that you would expect from such an event, like mask wearing, of course, I believe maybe temperature checks,
mm-hmm.
and they're taking all the appropriate security measures, distancing with seats and whatnot, so we can have a safe performance. And most importantly, the audience won't be too close to the dangerous brass players.
which you are one of. What instrument do you play?
I'm a trumpeter.
Okay. What do you like about the trumpet?
Well, it's an interesting question. The trumpet sort of came to me rather than me to the trumpet. My dad is a musician and pianist, still playing today, and was my first music educator, and he actually played the trumpet as well through middle school and high school. So the trumpet was waiting for me, collecting dust in the basement when it came time for me to pick an instrument in the fifth grade band.
And from then on, it's been nothing but success. Aren't you the youngest member to ever join Canadian Brass?
Yeah, it's been 15 years ago now when I first joined the group at the ripe age of 20.
And so, you're so old now. No, yeah. Actually the opposite of that. Okay, so this is great because people have missed live music so much. And not only can they come see Canadian Brass on the 14th at Florida Theater, this is a free show too, although you do have to reserve a ticket, correct?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, Beaches Fine Arts is making this possible. For everyone. So.
Yeah, exactly right. The Beaches Fine Arts series is the presenter for Canadian Brass at the Florida Theater. They are really just do an amazing job of bringing these kinds of shows and concerts to the First Coast. You can learn more at beachesfinearts.org. And so to prepare for the big show on the 14th, tell me a little bit about how does the band interact with the audience? How do you, with these particular brass instruments, tell me what it's like in a live setting, even if it is a socially distant, smaller audience, to be performing live with these kinds of instruments?
Yeah, there's certainly some modifications that we have to make to our show now, because in the past we were really used to getting close to the audience. I mean, we will still, of course, speak to the audience between numbers, but for instance, we start our show traditionally with a song called Just a Closer Walk with Thee, which is a traditional New Orleans jazz song, and we perform it similarly. You might see it in New Orleans in the way a band might parade up and down the streets playing this. We parade in from the back of the hall playing this song to open our concerts. And we've been told that this, unless there's a way to go about doing this while maintaining distance from people, that certain things like that need to be modified. We even go to the audience to create an antiphonal effect of playing with some numbers, but we'll still make do with some antics that are a little bit different than what you would expect from a concert like this with acoustic brass instruments.
Yeah,
we definitely
yeah.
try to make our music relatable.
It'll be a great show. Brandon Ridenour playing trumpet with the world-famous Canadian Brass. It's a free concert Sunday, March 14th at the Florida Theater. Doors open at 3 o'clock. Show is at 4. This is presented courtesy of Beaches Fine Arts. Get your ticket through their website or call 904-355-ARTS. Have a great show, and thanks so much, Brandon.
Thanks. Looking forward to being there.
That's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Questions or comments? Send an email, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm A.G. Gankarski, sitting in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back on Monday, but if you missed anything, listen to the rebroadcast at 8 p.m. and find today's show at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.